The Jewish Heritage Foundation presents The Epic of the Eternal People, an in-depth study of Jewish history based on original source material given by Rav Shmuel Irons, Rosh HaKollel, Dean of the Kollel Institute of Greater Detroit, one of the leading centers of Talmudic research and community education in North America. This lecture, titled Shmuel HaKoton and the Rise of Christianity, is the first of a 16-part series, From Yavna to Beitar. This lecture was originally given at Machon LaTorah, the Jewish Learning Network of Michigan, and is dedicated to the memories and the Ilui Nishmos Sora Pesha Bas Mordechai, Mrs. Sarah Scher, Esther Bas Shlomo Zalman, Mrs. Esther Schwartz, and Rivka Bas Yaakov, Mrs. Rivka Herzog, Aleichem HaSholem, of blessed memory.
One of the major problems we face as a society, which is not readily fixed by allocating new funds or making new legislation, is the dearth of inspirational role models. In other words, there's a lack of heroes. Those so-called heroes, which are known far and wide in society, whether in the realm of politics or sports or entertainment, are very often morally flawed and very poor examples. And the problem of having someone to point out to, you can show your children and say, look at that person. That's the kind of person I'd like you to grow up to be. It's something that even our community often suffers from. Because it's part and parcel of human nature that we do need someone to look up to model ourselves after. And without it, it's very difficult for us to reach our potential. And according to the Torah, that potential is awesome. If you look in the outline, in section 1A, we quote from the Rambam. And the Rambam first stresses the idea, which is central to Judaism, that we are given the gift of free will. We have the power to change the course of our lives. It's very interesting, by the way, that that idea, which is so central to Judaism, is not taken for granted by all. The Rambam himself points to non-Jews and Jews who held that all is fated. In fact, it was a central tenet of Islam, the idea of fate. And also the early fathers of Protestantism. Those who remember in the 12th lecture of our last series, we quoted from Josephus, who stated that the beliefs of the Essenes was also that of fate, that a person is destined to be a tzaddik, righteous, or a rasha, an evil person. And it was the Pharisees, the Perushim, basically the Rabbonim that we're studying tonight, were held the belief that we all have free will. And when we exercise that free will, the Rambam continues, we have the potential to be as great as Moses, as Moshe Rabbeinu. And as the Rambam says, every person has the potential to be a saint, tzaddik, like Moshe, or an evil person like Yeravam. Yeravam is the one who introduced the cult of the golden calves, a form of idolatry in the northern kingdom of Israel. He is listed in the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadi, 90a, as one of those who has no portion in the world to come. We all have free will. And the Rambam bases himself on two citations, one in the Talmud, if you notice on section B now, on page 1, that when a person is born, when by the conception, there's an angel, there's a force which is guided by God and determines at that point what the course of that person's life is going to be, what the person's intelligence is going to be, his strength, both physical and psychological, even his wealth, the course of his life is going to take. In fact, that there's another passage in the Talmud, there's one in Sota, in Beis Omer Aleph, in 2a, that says that even the marriage, at that point, who one's spouse is going to be, the home he's going to live in, the property, the field that he's going to own, is predetermined. However, what he's going to do with his life, is he going to be a tzaddik or a rasha? Is he going to be a righteous person? Or God forbid, an evil person, every human being has the power to exercise. And then there's another quote we have, turn to page 2. It's paragraph C. Tana Devei Eliyahu, the Medrash, states that a person every day has to challenge himself and ask himself the question, when will my actions reach the heights of the actions of my forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov? In other words, the Midrash is saying we all have that potential. When am I going to fulfill that potential? So here the Rambam posits, A, we have free will, and B, we have an enormous potential. But how do we realize that potential? We quote from the Rambam on paragraph D. And let me quote this verbatim. It is human nature that one's character and actions are subject to the influence of one's friends and acquaintances, and that a person eventually changes and acts in accordance to the standards of the people of his community. Therefore, a person needs to attach himself to righteous people, to constantly sit by the scholars of Torah in order to learn from their actions. Furthermore, one should distance oneself from evil people who walk in darkness so as not to learn from their actions. And he goes on to explain that there's actually one of the mitzvahs of the Torah, it's a positive commandment, to cling socially to the scholars of the Torah. In terms of one's business dealings, marriage into a family, social engagements. In other words, since we are a product of our environment, we have to mold our environment to fit our goals. And he says part and parcel of that, and actually a mitzvah of the Torah, is to be by people who will have the greatest positive influence upon us. But besides the socialization, and he continues on the Rambam, the idea of studying by their feet and creating, having an intimate relationship with them, there's an interesting approach that the Talmud takes. And this is, if you look on the top of page 3. It says, when you sit in the presence of your teacher, look at his mouth, look how he's talking. Your eyes should behold your teacher. there's something spiritual or magical just being in looking at that person. This is the Gemara in Horius, this is in Yudbeis Amud Aleph in 12a. But there's, we continue on in paragraph F, that not only was it good advice, but evidently you see it works. This is Omar Rabbi, this is Rebbe, the editor of the Mishnah. The reason I'm sharper than my colleagues, because I saw the back of Rabbi Meir. I didn't even see him face to face. I just saw him from the back. There's an incident which is recorded in Yerushalmi and Beitza that he had the occasion just to look at him. It was a fleeting glance. Had I seen him from the front, I would have been sharper yet. And again, he quotes this scripture. And your eyes should behold your teacher. The Yerushalmi in Shkolim adds, this is paragraph J, that even when you don't see him, you've attended his class, he's not here now, you're a teacher in your own right, you're repeating over his statement, in your mind you should visualize as if he would be standing here. You should have that sense of presence. And it quotes the scripture, it says, Ach betzelem yisalachish, only in the shadow of one's mentor, one feels in the, should a person walk. One has the sense of presence. He's not alone. He's not speaking on his own. He has that link to his Rebbe, to his teacher. But what do you do if you don't know the man you've studied from? You don't know him. If he's lived 2,000 years ago. How are you going to benefit from him, not only as a source of information, but also a source of inspiration? And on this we've based our this series of 10 lectures. To get to know the people that are our teachers. Who were they? What do they stand for? What kind of lives did they live? So that short of knowing them or seeing them, but we'll have a good idea of who they were. So they, in some small way, will have a lasting influence upon us. The period under discussion is from the end of the life of Hillel. Hillel died in the year 10 of the Common Era, till right before the rebellion of Bar Kokhba, which occurred in the year 132. We begin with Shmuel HaKotan, who was a disciple of Hillel, and we end with Rabbi Akiva, who, as we're going to see, had some involvement with the Bar Kokhba rebellion. I plan, Mirtz Hashem, to follow with an additional 6 lectures about the period in general, that we have a fuller, richer background of the time. I hope to give a lecture on the Dead Sea Scrolls, on the life of Josephus, on the mass suicide of Masada, of anti-Semitism in antiquity, about the different communities in the diaspora, what communal life was, where they lived, and finally, about the view in the Talmud of miracles and witchcraft. But this will follow this present group of lectures. There's another purpose besides the inspiration why I've chosen to focus on this period on the biographies, the lives of the Tanoim, the teachers of the Mishnah. In general literature, the people, the teachers of the Mishnah, are known as the Pharisees. In the last series, we've discussed the Pharisees, especially in Lecture 12. In the English language, Pharisaic is synonymous with being hypocritical. And that's based, of course, on the view of the Pharisees that are given to us by the authors of the New Testament. I think it's important for us to have a view of them as their students looked at them, the Pharisees, see their own writings and how their memory was preserved by Jews for all ages. I'd like to begin now where we left off. And this was the life of Hillel and in the period of Herod. If you turn to page 4. Even though we discussed the beginning of Herod's life at length, this is in Lecture 14 of the last series, and we ended off with a summary as Herod was described by the Jewish leaders who came to plea with the Romans that they should take away the government from Herod's son, Archelaus, and put it in the hands of the Romans themselves. And it describes a long list of the crimes that Herod had perpetrated against the Jewish people. I would like now to give the Talmud's view of Herod. And I'm not going to quote from what we have verbatim, but I'd like to summarize. You could look at it as I'm speaking. Even though Josephus alludes to the fact that Herod was an Edomian from Edom, and he comes from a race of people that were forcibly converted by Yochanan Hyrcanus. He was Yochanan Hyrcanus, if you recall, the son of Shimon, Simon, the last surviving of the five Maccabee brothers. It is not clear why is it that Herod was treated with such disfavor by the Jews. They looked down upon him. Generally, the treatment of converts is stressed in the Torah to be of the highest importance. But besides the mitzvah to love one another, there's a special mitzvah to love a convert and to treat him decently and honestly. And yet he goes on and on to describe the way they looked at him and they mistreated him. In the Talmud, from the Talmud's version though, we get a clearer picture of what was the problem with Herod. It was in terms of his genealogy. In the eyes of the Talmud, he was considered an Eved, a slave. The forcible conversion of Edomia was not to make them normal converts, but really to actually make them slaves. And a slave had a certain special status in Jewish life. He was a quasi-Jew. He was required to do the bulk of the mitzvahs of the Torah. But on the other hand, he wasn't allowed to marry another Jew. And it was a special status of slave. That was Herod's status. This idea we don't get from the reading of Josephus. After Josephus also was very friendly with Agrippas II, the last so-called king of the Herodian line, and much of what he wrote was, he always had in mind a certain deference to his patron. The description of how he killed out his masters is through a bas-call. Hear the heavenly voice, which we're going to discuss a little later on. And he went out. I mean, how the Talmud phrases it, it seems to be an instantaneous thing. In actuality, it was well planned and took many years. But he killed out the whole house of the Herodian line, of the Hashmonaim line. There was one girl left. As you see, she committed suicide. But publicly, even though she had died, he claimed to the public that he had married her and perpetrated this great lie. That's the version that the Talmud has. And in fact, to the extent that anyone claims to be from that the Hashmonaim line is in reality not truly from that line, but an imposter, and really a slave. It was a true descendant of Herod with some slave woman. It wasn't from the family of the Hashmonaim. That girl died without children. A large portion of the book of the works of Josephus is dedicated towards the end, when he deals with Herod, is his marriage with Miriam, and the children that he had with her. He finally killed them all. He left grandchildren, but he killed his children, and he killed his wife. From the version of the Talmud, the whole story was a great lie. In fact, Josephus's sources were taken by works that were written by Hasidim, by the followers of Herod himself. One of the major works that he borrowed from Josephus is Nicholas of Damascus, who was in the pay of Herod. He would be the equivalent of a press secretary today. And he wrote a biography of Herod. That was one of the major works that he borrowed from Josephus. So according to the Talmud, not only is he a murderer, which we have verification, but he created this whole story to prop up his position, because now he's married to the last surviving member, gives him a certain credibility. But realizing that the rabbis, the Perushim, the Pharisees, knew the true story, he made it his point to kill out as many as he could. The language of the Talmud that he killed out all the rabbis is really is not exactly correct. I mean, Hillel and Shammai were saved, and Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai were saved, but many Rabbonim were killed. And the Talmud tells us about the fact is he left Bava ben Buta, who was in the Talmud, he's noted as one of the elder scholars of the school of Shammai. He left him alive, blinded him, but wanted to tap his genius. And one time, Herod disguised himself. I mean, disguised his voice, sat next to Bava ben Buta, and started complaining about Herod. What kind of a terrible person he is. And you should curse him. I was at least feeling the senses of the curse of from Bava ben Buta would have an effect. And he saw, Herod, the great caution the Bava ben Buta had, his reluctance to say even the slightest word against Herod, for fear they would get back to him. And at that point,
Herod realized that he had made a mistake by killing the Rabbonim, killing the Perushim, that they really weren't his enemies. And as the Talmud describes, he had pangs of remorse. He wanted to do something to make up for the ills that he had created. And here Bava Ben Buta suggested to him that he should rebuild the temple. He did rebuild the temple. And if we could look on page 5, we'll read the description of that temple. Anyone who's visited Israel has seen the Western Wall, seen that as a wall. This is the bottom part, is the wall that actually Herod built. They have said, this is a quote from the Yad Gemara in Bava Basra, this is a Gemara in Sukkah as well, from Nun Aleph on Beis 51b. He who never saw the temple, the Beis HaMikdash that Herod built, never saw a beautiful structure in his life. How did he build it? Rabba said, with gray-brown marble, is a goldish-brownish marble, and white marble. There are those that say that his statement was also with blue marble, the golden-brown, the gray-brown marble, and white marble. One row projected out, and the next row receded. Originally, they had it that it would be plastered, and it would eventually plate it with gold. But the rabbis told him to leave it because it looks much more beautiful without the gold, for it has the appearance of the waves of the sea. And that's how the sanctuary looked. This was his greatest, let's say, to Jewry, despite all the ills that he created and all the suffering that he left for that short period of time, he left us with the temple. Rav Huttner Zatzal, the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshivas Chaim Berlin, says in a discourse of his, that the significance of the waves of the sea, verses, that the rabbis realized that the temple would have a very short lifespan. This is something we discussed in the first series, that the whole period of the Second Temple was a temple in Golos. It was never meant to be a permanent structure. It was a structure built for the diaspora, and its whole lifespan would only be 420 years, based on this. We've discussed this before. It seems it's based on will be the accepted interpretation of a verse in Daniel, that the span between the destruction of the first temple and the second temple was a period of 490 years. There was a 70-year period from the destruction of the first temple to the building of the second temple, and an additional 420 years for the existence of the second temple. They realized the temple was only a temporary structure. But yet, like the waves of the sea, as it comes to a crest, it has the appearance it's going to go on forever, but then it just dies down and it recedes. So too, the idea of the temple says, "Bishas chedvosa chedvosa." In the time of joy, let there be joy, even though it may be only temporary. That's what we see in the waves of the sea. When it comes to its height, you forget about what the future is going to be. There's the sense of it's short, but let's enjoy the present. So that would be the symbolism, according to Rav Huttner, of the waves of the sea, of why the sanctuary had that appearance. It was a message to everyone. it's only going to be for a short period of time, but while it's here, let's use it to its fullest. It was in this atmosphere that Hillel flourished. Hillel came to be the president of Sanhedrin some 3 years after Herod came to power. And he was in his office for a period of 40 years, Hillel. He outlived Herod by some 13 years. And he created a dynasty that lasted long after him. In fact, the very last member of the dynasty that Hillel created was also called Hillel. And it was under his jurisdiction that the Jewish calendar, as we have it now, was created. Because that Jewish calendar no longer depends on the courts to proclaim every new moon, that is basically it's predicted. And if one knows the formula, one could actually predict when every month is going to come out and what day exactly is Pesach going to be in 100 years from now or 2,000 years from now, was an institution that his great-great-grandchild created. In fact, according to Isaac Halevi, the last Hillel was the 13th generation from the first one. So he created a dynasty of presidents of the Sanhedrin. After Hillel, the Sanhedrin ceased to function. It came to a close. That was the time Hillel's office was concurrent with Julian III, the last pagan emperor of Rome, who was very sympathetic to the Jews. Afterwards, the Christians again came into power, and it was impossible for the Sanhedrin to function. Hillel's most famous legacy is the love of Torah, the love of humanity that he left each and every one of us. He's on page 5, paragraph C. Hillel and Shammai received the Torah from Shammai and Avtalion. Hillel said, "You should be from the disciples of Aaron." This is the brother of Moshe, Moses, the first high priest. What was his Aaron's personality? Love peace, pursue peace, love humanity, and bring them closer to the Torah. We know in terms of Hillel's greatness that he left over a family. He had a son Shimon, who in turn had a son Gamliel, who in turn had a son Shimon. And for 100 years, while the temple still existed, these four generations led Jewry. But there was another area that Hillel exceeded. And that was, in a sense, his spirituality. If you turn to page 6, look on section C. This is a quote from the Yerushalmi and Sota. Look, we're going to go in the first, we'll go to the second paragraph of C. Rabbi Yaakov Bar Idi, in the name of Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, said, "There was an occurrence when the elders entered the attic," there's a second floor based Nadia in Yericho, in Jericho. As we're going to see, we'll be often quoting about the idea of the base medrash of the house of study in the attic, in the aliyah, in the second story. That was common in antiquity. The bottom floor held the pillars, and the top floor, and that was used for living space, the top floor was where the Beis Medrash was. And while they were there, Hillel and his elders, there was a bas kol, there was a sound from heaven. And the voice said, there are two in this room that are fit to receive Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. Hillel the elder is one of them. The Gemara explains in Sanhedrin that at the beginning of the Second Temple, prophecy came to an end. There was no longer that communication. But even though the prophecy came to an end, there was another minor form of communication, how the spiritual world communicated, how Hashem communicated to the physical world. And that was by means of a bas kol, the sound. According to the Ramban, one has to normally merit to be able to hear that sound. There are other occurrences where even a person like Herod could hear this. But they heard the sound that there are two people that had prophecy still been in existence, they would be prophets. One was Hillel. And he looked around the room, who is the other most likely candidate? And they looked at Shmuel HaKotan, Shmuel the lesser, the small, as the most other likely possibility. We were introduced to a person who would be the equivalent of Hillel in terms of his ability to receive Nevuah, prophecy. And it continues on, the Talmud Yerushalmi, that at a later date the elders entered the attic at Yavne. We're familiar with Yavne. And again, the Beis Medrash again was at a second story. And there a heavenly voice came out and said to them, there are two amongst you that are fit to receive divine inspiration. Hillel had already passed away. Shmuel HaKotan is one of them. And they looked at Rabbi Eliezer ben Hyrcanus. This is going to be the subject of a fifth lecture in this series, as the most other likely possibility. And it continues on, they were happy that their opinion and their estimation, Shmuel HaKotan, when the first message was given, they were happy that they had judged correctly. The idea of someone called HaKotan is just very, you know, very strange. Shmuel the small. Those who are familiar with Robin Hood know about Little John, but it was a euphemism. The Yerushalmi's bothered by this. And if you look in the first paragraph of section C here, why was Shmuel HaKotan called HaKotan? Well, how did he get his name? And there are two explanations about, really, it changes the whole definition of the term cotton, the small. One means Shmuel the humble, because he's small, and others in terms of his humility. He made himself small. He's a very great person. He's a very humble person. The other explanation is that he's called Shmuel the lesser of the two Shmuels. There are two famous Shmuels in history. One is Shmuel HaNovi, Samuel the prophet. And he is of the two, he is the smaller of the two. He's way up there, but he's of the two, he's the smaller. Evidently, when you're compared with, when you're compared in that league, it tells you a lot about the person. As we quote this at the end of, come back on page 5, there's an idea which is often quoted, it's quoted in the Talmud and the Medrash, Medrash Koheles. This is on On page 5, this is on, this is in 3, Roman numeral 3a. A tzaddik does not depart from this world until another tzaddik like him is created. Does Hashem, looking after the world, tries to make, there is an element of course of free will, but within those parameters at least tries to make sure that there's a replacement that will be there. The sun shone and the sun set. Tohelas. Zvezorach HaShemesh, Vor HaShemesh. Before the son of Eli was extinguished, Eli was the mentor of the original Shmuel, the son of Shmuel shone. Shmuel came into existence, Samuel the prophet. So too, before Hillel died, there was a Shmuel HaKotan. He didn't take that position of leadership that the sons of Hillel and grandchildren of Hillel took. But evidently in terms of the quality of his character, he was compared and almost on a par to Hillel himself. What kind of a person was he? What did he do besides the appellates that the Talmud, both the Talmud Bava and Yerushalmi gives him? We don't know that much. But there's one particular incident that the Talmud left us with, which gives us this inkling of what kind of a person he truly was. Now we have, as we explain, a system that was created by Hillel's descendant, that we know how to calculate the intercalated year. This is, we discussed this in the 7th lecture of our last series, that since there's a discrepancy between the solar calendar, which is approximately 365 days, 365 and a quarter days, and the lunar calendar, which is approximately 354 days, it's important if we want to keep them in sync. The Muslim calendar is not in sync, actually. But if we want to keep the lunar in sync with the solar calendar, it's important at irregular intervals to add an extra month to a year. How the system we have it was set up is that in a space of 19 years, there will be 7 years that will have an extra month. In other words, in the 19-year cycle, the 3rd, 6th, 8th, 11th, 14th, 17th, and 19th year will have an extra month. But that was the creation of the last Sanhedrin. Before that, there was much more latitude based on other considerations. We want to make sure that it's, when Pesach comes out, not only is it springtime based on the solar calendar, but actually spring has come because of other climatic conditions. It may be spring late in the year. Then Pesach, we would like to have Pesach then a little later. So it should come together with actual spring. It makes a difference in Omer. In Eretz Yisrael, the new grain is forbidden to be eaten until a sacrifice is brought on the second day of Pesach. There's a question here of if there's a problem of famine. If we put we create the intercalated year this year, we're going to push it. In other words, what we do is then add an extra month Adar. It's 2 Adars. In other words, Pesach will come out later. If it comes out later, then when the sacrifice is brought, people have to wait an extra month in order to eat the new grain. And if there's a scarcity of the old grain, we may be causing an undue burden on the populace. So there are various variables that the Sanhedrin which would deal on a year-by-year basis, would take into consideration. And there were taken 7 scholars to deal with all the different factors involved in order for them to make the decision, should this year have an intercalculated, have an extra month, or should it not? The Talmud describes an incident that when they met, and it says, it states clearly that they only meet at the behest of the Nasi, the president of the Sanhedrin. When the 7 members were called to come, and Rabbi Gamliel came in to lead the discussion, he found there were not 7, but 8 people there. You know, I can see, let's try this again. 1, 2, you know, a Shia, Esa. The king is 8. And we turn to page 7 here. It just worked out that way. Yeah. Whoever came to the attic without permission should please leave. This is what Rabbi Gamliel said. Rabbi Gamliel is the grandson of Hillel. Shmuel HaKotan rose and says, I'm the one that came up without permission, you know, excused himself. I didn't actually come to participate in the determination, but rather felt necessary to learn practical halacha, like I wanted to see how you do it. Rabbi Gamliel replied to him and says, stay, my son, stay. It would be fit that you would have participated in determinations of every year. You know, you're... The sages declared that only those who were officially asked may actually participate, so I can't let you participate, but, you know, but please stay. The truth was, he was one of those that were asked. The Rabbi Gamliel personally didn't ask. He had a committee of people to appoint, those that would be selected. He didn't know actually who was selected or not. When he came up, he found them. Shmuel HaKotan was really one of those that was selected. But he didn't want to embarrass the person who came up without permission. And as a result, he took the blame. But in order to prevent his colleague's embarrassment, you know, he got up and said, it was me. The Talmud learns from this a very important principle and goes on to explain that in generations that followed, there were similar type of incidents. That others, learning from the example of Shmuel HaKotan, took the blame just not to embarrass someone else. But there's some, besides this, would be like a peek into his own, we have a sense of what his character was. Shmuel HaKotan left us something that has become a permanent part of Jewish life. Originally, when the Anshei Knesset HaGdola, that Sanhedrin, that group of scholars that led Jewry in the beginning of the Second Temple period, when they created a standardized form of davening, of prayer, they created in the weekdays 18 prayers, Shmon Asrei. Was it 18 prayers? And that's the way things were for almost 400 years. However, there was a pressing need to add a 19th blessing, and that's the blessing of the Lamal Shinim that we say to this day. And now we're going to go through, says, what is the history of this bracha? And it was actually, as we're going to see, it was Shmuel HaKotan was the one who formulated it. And let us just go back before this to the role of the Sanhedrin. Normally, the place of Sanhedrin is in a special room right
in the temple complex. In fact, the room that was in actually abutted the temple, that half of the room actually belonged to the temple proper, and half of it was the had its sanctity was that of the Temple Mount. But if you go past a certain point on that room, it actually would be considered now you're in the temple. The difference being that in the temple, everyone had to stand. You couldn't sit in the temple. On the other part of the room, you could sit down. And it's that part, which was not in the temple proper, was where the Sanhedrin sat. So the room was really almost like abutted, was a part of the temple. And it was called Lishkos Hagozes. It was the room of hewn stone, of marble, or limestone. And then that was the room was used for the Sanhedrin. 40 years before the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, the Sanhedrin left that room, never to return. There's an opinion of Tosfos in Ksubas in Lamed Amud Beis in 30b that in certain extreme circumstances they came back to their original quarters. It was very rare, if at all. And they moved to an area on the Temple Mount called Honus. Why did they move? The Sanhedrin, as we said before, its place is on the temple, is right by the temple. And when the Sanhedrin is in, or has its place, all the other lower courts, that whole system, is also in place. When the Sanhedrin moves, and no longer functions as Sanhedrin, the lower courts cannot function as lower courts either. If there's no Sanhedrin, there's no system of courts. One of the prime functions of a Sanhedrin is to deal with capital crimes. Not only the highest Sanhedrin, the one on the Temple Mount, but every city had its court of 23 judges. Who were appointed judges who could deal with capital crimes. So it wasn't just the one on the temple or the one in Yerushalayim. Every Sanhedrin, every court could deal with capital crimes. But they could only work if there was the highest Sanhedrin. Sanhedrin Gedola was in its place by the Beis HaMikdash. Once they moved, it was the equivalent if it's non-functioning. It's not in its place. It's not working. It's like you take the plug off of your computer. Like it just does nothing to work. And therefore, none of the lower courts could deal with capital crimes because they were no longer considered truly Sanhedrin. There were still scholars. They could deal with monetary issues that did not need a Sanhedrin per se. They could deal with flogging where all you needed was three. But that system of courts of 23 throughout the land needed that its highest court was in its proper place. When they moved, it could no longer function. And they wanted out, so to speak. They no longer wanted the responsibility of having to try capital crimes. Because lawlessness reached such a pitch. And the amount of murders that were there was such that Sanhedrin, based on the Torah, had the responsibility of trying these people, but it was just, they felt just beyond them, or it was just too much pressure for them because of the corruption of the Roman officials. I mean, it really wasn't their land anymore. They were dominated by Romans. At this time was Pontius Pilate, which we'll discuss a little further on, who's known through just general history as the one who was supposed to have, the one who's killed the founder of Christianity, was the
was the prefect, the procurator of Judea. He was the Roman official that represented the Roman government. He was a very corrupt person, very insensitive to the needs of the Jews. And Sanhedrin felt that they would rather just disband the whole system rather than having the responsibility of prosecuting all these people and not fulfilling their mandate. So basically, by moving from the Lishkas HaGozos, from the room on the Temple Mount, to Chanus, they freed themselves from that responsibility. They were still the highest court, in the sense this is the highest authority of legal opinion, but in terms of trying capital crimes, they no longer could and no longer had that responsibility. They did not stay in Chonos for very long, this area. They moved from the Temple Mount eventually to Yerushalayim. And from Yerushalayim, they moved to Yavne. When all this occurred, the time frame of all this is not all that clear. How many years were they in this area? How many years were they in that area? It's not all that clear. One thing, though, seems to be, and we're going to speak about this when we speak about the third lecture of this series. By the time the Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai left Yerushalayim in the midst of its siege, this is probably the year 69, and came to Vespasian, he asked Vespasian to preserve the scholars who were living in Yavne. At the time of the siege, it had already moved. How many years before that is not all that clear. However, it seems that if we place Shmuel HaKotan as a contemporary of Hillel, perhaps a very young contemporary of Hillel, but a contemporary of Hillel, and as we're going to see, that Shmuel HaKotan died, at least according to the text that we have in the Talmud, before the temple was destroyed. It was already in Shmuel HaKotan's lifetime that the move was made to Yavne. Why Yavne? This is something we'll discuss at a later lecture. But it was in Yavne that Rabbi Gamliel assembled the Sanhedrin and gave the scholars a mandate that there was a necessity to add to the 18 blessings. He first of all made sure, because of the different nuschoyas, the different versions that had cropped up through the years, there was a question of, there were those who had certain brachas first and others after, to make sure that it's standardized, to research and find out what the original Takana, what the original institution of prayer was that was instituted some 400 years before, and to finalize what would be the version that we would have for all generations. So first he set prayer. He realized the end was coming. The second thing he did was he found the need to add a new prayer. And this was Birchas. This is the V'lam al Shinim, or called Birchas Haminim. This is the bracha for the heretics. And now I'd like to quote now, at least this is the Rambam's opinion, of why it was created. On page 8, in paragraph E. In the days of Rabban Gamliel, the heretics, the Rambam calls the apokorsim, amongst the Jews increased and were persecuting the Jews, enticing them to forsake Hashem. So he deals with two problems. One was persecution, and one was they were mesisim. They were enticing them to leave Torah. Since Rabban Gamliel saw that this was the most important problem to deal with, he and his court arose and instituted a single benediction that contains a plea towards Hashem to eliminate heretics.
and he said it in the regular prayer so it may be fluent in the mouths of all. It comes out, then, that there are now 19 brachas in the regular prayer instead of the original 18. And it was Shmuel HaKotan, as you look on page, on page 8, on paragraph D, just above this, when Rabban Gamliel asked that who knows how to institute this additional bracha, it was Shmuel HaKotan who arose and formulated it. Why Shmuel HaKotan? Again, we can only speculate. Perhaps it is, as we see in the previous quotes, that he was the equivalent, the equal of Hillel, of being fit to have prophecy, to have Ruach HaKodesh. That a person of that stature would know, says, how to formulate the prayer. As Rav Chaim Volozhiner points out, this is Rav Chaim Volozhiner was the disciple of the Gaon, the Vilna Gaon. The 18 prayers that we have, each word is there for a purpose. In the sense, the formulation could only have been created by the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah, the men of the Great Assembly, because many of them were actually prophets. There's over 30 of them were prophets. Perhaps it was important of this, if a new blessing was created, it had to be of someone of such stature. Perhaps another reason is that we needed somebody who was pure and was free from any hatred, that the prayer was given was not because of some personal vendetta, but was only for the sake of the cause itself. If you notice on page 8 in paragraph F, Shmuel HaKotan is the author in Pirkei Avos, and there are various quotes from the various teachers of the Mishnah. He doesn't formulate it in his own words. He really quotes a verse in Proverbs: "When your enemy falls, be not happy. When a fall yivchal tismach. And when he stumbles, let your heart not be joyous." So perhaps it was because of a person of such purity and noble motives can only create such a prayer. Who were these Minim? Who were these heretics that they were so concerned about? And what is the meaning of the word mean, which is a very strange word? We know the word mean is used normally in biblical Hebrew, is a variety. Borei minei mizonos, types of grains, of sources of sustenance. How does the word mean a heretic? So in the first quote we have, look on page 9, on page 8, excuse me, on the bottom. We don't have this translated. The word mean comes from, there's a word which is used in the, very often in the Talmud, it's a biblical word. It's moin, which means refuse or deny. And there's a word me'anim, which is quoted in Jeremiah, which has the sense of those who deny, those who refuse. So it would be in Mishnaic Hebrew, it changed from me'anim, which is difficult to pronounce, to minim. That's one theory. But then it would refer to a class, anyone who's a heretic. This fits well with the Rambam, who defines heresy. He puts five different classes of heresy. The idea of the denial of God himself, the one who believes in idolatry of multiple gods, he calls them all minim. We do have the sense of mean, at least if this is the correct
text of the Mishnah. And again, we're never sure because of all the hands of the censors that went through the Talmud. We're never 100% really sure of what the original text was. But there's a passage in the Gemara, in the Mishnah in Brachos, in the beginning of the ninth, and it's in the, as it's printed in Talmud, it's really one of the latter Mishnahs in the ninth parak of Brachos. It's in Nun Dalet Omer Aleph, 54a. That the Anshe Knesset HaGdolu, the men of the great assembly, added a form of their prayer, and they said, Baruch Hashem mi'olom v'yad olam, let Hashem be blessed from this world to the next world. Previously, there had not been this stress of the next world. But Mishakilkalu Haminim, when the Minim destroyed or began to undermine the belief system of Jewry, the Anshe Knesset HaGdolu, this is the leaders in the beginning of the Second Temple period, this is circa the year 350 before the Common Era, instituted the stress of saying, yes, there's another world, there's a world to come. The Minim that they were focusing on, if Min is the correct text, were people who were really secularists, which is similar to the beliefs of the Tzedukim, which later became a major force some 200 years later. So then the Min then is just a, basically, those are deniers, would be according to this school. There's another school of thought which has historical problems, is the opinion of the Yaivetz, of Yaakov Emden, claims the word Min comes from the word Minoi. According to him, it's Minoi, who is the founder of the school of dualism. He has a particular school. I don't know, it says his name is Manus or Menachus. We're familiar with literature, there's a Manichaean belief of the worlds of good and bad, of light and darkness, which he was the author of. It's a nice theory. The problem is he lived much after the Mishnah. Like, he was born in the year 217, so it was really a little late for this word to be based on this manus. There's another theory, though, that the word Min originally meant not a heretic, but really an early Christian. And it's not all clear if that is through meaning, but according to this school of thought, it's an acronym. Mem Yud Nun is Mamine, those who believe in Yeshu Notzri, the Nazarene. Jesus the Nazarene, the believers of Yeshu. Again, it's not all clear if that really is the meaning of it, but the early church believed that, the church authorities believed that was the meaning of it, and made sure, when they began to censor the Talmud, that they took out every reference to the word mean, because they felt it was meant as a direct attack against them. If we assume that the word mean is a generic term, then at least one could, if we assume also that this happened in the second, this whole formulation happened in the Second Temple period, before the Christians came to power, then the idea of the Rambam that we made it because they were persecuting us would not deal with the early Christians who themselves were persecuted, but actually the Tzedukim, the Sadducees, who were like the Minim that are mentioned in the ninth chapter of Brachos, those who did not believe in an afterlife. In other words, they were secularists. And then they historically were giving many problems. They were the source of much pain to Jewry. This is recorded, in as we're going to see in a later lecture, is recorded both in our sources. We see the problems with them as recorded in Josephus. According to that, then, the thrust was the Sadducees. If we define mean, of course, is Maimina Yeshu Notzri, then the thrust was to the early Christians. One thing that would at least support partially this idea of mean referring to the early Christians is a quote we did not translate. It's on paragraph F on page 9. About a Sefer Torah that was written by a mean should be burned. Rashi defines mean as an idolater. And he explains that the name of Hashem was written with a polytheistic or a pagan idea in mind. Whatever you're going to say about the Sadducees, they were monotheists. The pagans of antiquity did not write Sifrei Torah. That wasn't their thing, they had their own thing. But if we assume that it's referring really to early Christians, and the idea of the Father and the Son as dual gods was considered in the eyes of Chazal, of the sages, as a form of idolatry, one could understand then the idea of that when they write it, they mean something else than when we write it. And therefore it becomes not a work of Torah, but really it becomes a work of idolatry. Who are these meaning? We really can never know. But if you see, this is in paragraph C, on page 9, we quote from the Bahag, the Baal Halachas Gedolos, who was one of the Gaonim, who lived in the 7th and 8th century of the Common Era, in the period after the Talmud, that equates him with Yeshu HaNotzri Ben Pandira. In other words, this is Yeshu Nazarene Notzri Ben Pandira, the son of Pandira. According to the in the short period we have now, and again the idea of early Christianity itself deserves a whole major lecture. We discussed this in Shavuos night for around 3 hours last. But there are the Talmud describes a person called Yeshu HaNotzri. At least in the early text, the unexpunged versions. And again, when we deal with unexpunged versions, we are never 100% sure, is this really what it is? We're dealing with old manuscripts. There are variances of the different manuscripts. The Ksav Yad Minchen, the Munich manuscript, describes what they call Yeshu HaNotzri, who was killed by Sanhedrin for three crimes. He was a Mesis Umediach. In other words, he tried to influence people to idolatry on a private basis, on a public basis, and he was a Machashef. He practiced witchcraft. And he was killed Erev Pesach, before Pesach. And he was not crucified, he was stoned to death. But Toluhu, after the stoning, they took his body and hung it up. In other words, they put the hands, tied the hands together and suspended him on a pole for a short period of time for people to see. He was taken off. It's in Parsha Kisetse, describes it. He was taken up and buried.
And it describes also having five disciples. One of them is Matthew, or Marcion. The problem of the identification of that with the figure mentioned in the New Testament was the one who was killed by Pontius Pilate was killed in his reign sometimes, and we're not sure, but between the year 26 and the year 36 when Pontius Pilate was the procurator, the prefect of Judea. Christian sources generally point to around the year 29 before the Common Era. This person called Yeshu HaNotri, it would seem, died in the time of Alexander Yanai. Alexander Yanai's reign came to a close in the year 76 before the Common Era. Almost 100 years, the death would be 100 years before the death of the person described in the New Testament. They sound so similar, but the time frame is totally off. There's another person discussed in the unexpunged versions of the Talmud called Ben Sadata. He was also stoned to death. He also was a Masist, in other words, one who tried to lure people to polytheism. He was also killed before Passover, and he was stoned and then he was hung up. He was not crucified. The Talmud does not give an exact date for his death. Is he somebody different than this Yeshu HaNotri, or is he the same? From the text that we have, we can't be entirely certain. One thing, though, is the Gemara. This is taken from Sanhedrin in 67a in an uncensored version. The Talmud asks, "How could he be called Ben Sadatos? Ben Pandira Shmoi? His name was the son of Pandira." Evidently, the Talmud knew he wasn't an obscure person. He knew who he was, Ben Pandira. Then the Talmud keeps on asking, well, Pandiro, maybe it's his mother's name. No, that's not his mother's name. His mother's name was Miriam Megadol Sarden Ishaya. It's Miriam who braids women's hair. So someone said, well, maybe her husband, Miriam's husband was, that was the father. No. The husband's name wasn't Pandiro, the husband's name was Popas Ben Yehuda. Finally, the Gemara comes as Boyo Pandira. He was an illegitimate child. This woman was married to Popas Ben Yehuda. She had an affair with someone called Pandira, and he was the result of that affair. And that's also Ben Sadata. It's similar to the word Sota, which is the adulterous woman. Again, there are certain parallels to this Ben Sadata and the person in the New Testament. There's another, the Gemara says in Shabbos, in Kuvdala on Mabez 104b, Ben Sadata, which is not expunged, it's an R thing, the Ben Sadata took witchcraft out of Egypt. He inscribed the secret codes in his skin, and he took it out of Egypt, which was the major source of the knowledge of witchcraft. So this Ben Sadata, we know, performed witchcraft, or miracles. He did miracles. He was in Egypt, which there is some slight Egyptian connection even with the life of Jesus. He was killed before Passover. So again, we have certain... Is he perhaps, even though there are differences, this was killed by Sanhedrin, the other one was killed by the Roman authorities, but is he perhaps the one of the New Testament? The problem is, there's a Tosefta in Chulin,
which brings a story that is really, it's two Tosefta, two passages of the Tosefta. Tosefta is an expansion of the Mishnah, which part of the story is really quoted in the Gemara in two places, in Avodah Zorah and Yud-Zayin Amud Aleph in 17a, and another passage in Avodah Zorah, in Chof Zayin Amud Beis in 27b, about Arhaz's Yeshu Hanotzri, or Yeshu Ben Pandira. So we have Yeshu, who is Ben Pandira. Up until now, we know Ben Sadato is Ben Pandira, a different person. But if he's Yeshu Ben Pandira, and according to the Ksav Yad Minchen, and as the Munich transcript, at least in our Talmud, it's Yeshu Hanotzri, so then Yeshu Hanotzri is just another way of is Ben Sadata. And that's why he was well known, and they could quote, well, he's Ben Pandira. They knew who he was. But here's a person, if they are all one and the same, and again, if we assume these texts are correct, and as we have the correct reading of these texts, we have a person of the 100 years before the person described in the New Testament. In addition, just another link between the two, there's a passage in the Talmud, another passage, a Nun Vav Amud Beis in Gittin, that has Unkelus, you know, the famous Unkelus, the author of the Aramaic translation of the Torah, seeking out the souls of past people who had to do with the Jews, and asking them through use of a medium to ask them whether he should convert to Judaism. And he contacted the soul of Bilam, the soul of Titus, the Roman general who eventually became Roman emperor, who destroyed the temple. And he contacted Yeshu Hanotzri. At least that's how the unexpunged version reads. And he asked him, what should he do? Bilam and Titus dissuaded him, tried to dissuade him. Yeshu Hanotzri tried to encourage him. And he asked, what is the... at least our version says, it points out the difference between even Yeshu, like how superior he was to the other two. And he said, what is the judgment of Yeshu? How is he suffering in purgatory? And they describe it, he's suffering like those who belittle the words of the sages. Evidently, this is a new facet that we don't see from the other quotes of the Talmud, about his malig al divrei chachamim. In other words, he pokes fun at the words of the sages. But yet, that also seems to fall into line with other things that we know about him from the New Testament. He had this running argument always with the Pharisees. But if all these people are one, what do we do with the missing 100 years? That really should be the subject of another lecture, and it's really way beyond the confines of this thing. And sometimes they say, a good kasha is a halba teretz. You know, a good question is a half an answer. But because of this discrepancy, there were two schools of thought. In the debates between the rabbis and the church authorities whether to ban the Talmud outright, there was a school of rabbis who maintained, because of discrepancy, there must be two different people. And there were others who maintained, the Ramban and the Abarbanel, that it's actually one and the same person. How did the missing 100 years? That's a subject of another discussion. But one could just more easily understand that if it had been around this sect for so many years, it had been a problem that really needed to be addressed.
Whereas if it would just have been a new sect that just arose, one wonders that why such an alarm, you know, it could just peter out by itself. In other words, why do they, to create a whole new blessing just for them? There are, of course, there are sections of in the New Testament itself that describe the resistance they had from the Pharisees. It's interesting to note that Rabban Gamliel, who's the author, I mean, he prodded this creation of this new blessing. When they brought before them some of the apostles, Rabban Gamliel took the lenient view that not to prosecute them. But evidently he had to do with them. We know that Paul, who began, you know, on the road to Damascus, he had his famous vision. He went ostensibly to persecute the early Christians. He claims, and we're going to bring this in, that he himself had studied by the feet of Gamaliel. He was a student of Rabbi Gamaliel. So there are things to point to in the nature of that there was a problem no matter when he lived. But it is really a problem that really needs serious scholarly discussion in any case. I'd like to conclude this. You see in the notes itself about his death. Before he died, he made a prophecy that Shimon and Yishmael were destined to be killed by the sword, and much suffering will come to the world and to his colleagues. How Rashi explains in many of the commentators that the Shimon and Yishmael that are discussed are the was Yishmael Kohen Gadol, the high priest, and Shimon ben Gamliel, the Nasi of the Sanhedrin. This is Rabban Gamliel's son, which is the subject of the next lecture that we're going to have. He left without any children when Shmuel HaKotan died. If you see on page 10, the eulogy that's been preserved. He was given the title Chosid and Onav, someone who's pious through love of God, someone who's humble. If you notice the last quote this is on section C, page 10. Both of them, there's a question, are both considered prerequisites to receive prophecy, which Shmuel HaKotan was most worthy of.
We hope you enjoyed this lecture. For more information about this lecture series and to order our audio cassettes and the accompanying outlines, please write to the Jewish Heritage Foundation, 15220 West Lincoln, Oak Park, Michigan, 48237.